If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
My friends, the great experiment.
The greatest trick.
Hidden
trick.
Would you look at that?
The greatest trick.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.
Welcome to Greatest Trek. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison. Got to get that energy up, Adam. This is we just got one last pilot season to get up over the hump.
My energy's up. Did I convey something unintentional? Do you think I'm a Cylon? My energy's a little weird for the moment.
Yeah, but I want a tissue sample that I can... What, burn up to see if, like, evidence of synthetic stuff comes off of it or something?
There's a ton of shit in this episode. Let's get right into it. We've been hanging on a cliff too long.
Yeah, behind the pod, we did take a week off between recording the last episode and this episode of Greatest Trek. So I think these were aired, like, on back-to-back nights, but...
It's true. On NBC.
Really?
Isn't that amazing?
No kidding.
That's what I read.
The National Broadcasting Corporation?
Have you seen the new fall shows?
Yes, I have seen them.
It's true, Ben, but as it is, our show airs on the Maximum Fun Network. Why don't we kick this one off?
Let's do it.
It's the finale of pilot season today, Ben, where we wrap up this two-parter of the pilot of Battlestar Galactica. It's Greatest Trek Pilot Season Episode 10, Battlestar Galactica, the miniseries, Part 2.
You know the greatest danger facing us is an irrational fear of the unknown.
So say we all!
People would have absolutely murdered us if we'd put the Space Above and Beyond episode here in the main feed and put the Part 2 of Battlestar Galactica in the bonus feed.
That's what we should have done.
We would have been run out of town on a rail, but I feel like we would have gotten a lot of subscribers.
Yeah, that bit of business might have actually worked.
That's not the way we roll.
That's not how it works.
We were dangling on a cliff when we left off. Apollo was probably dead in a 50-kiloton nuclear explosion.
And everyone on board Galactica is about to be, because the sense you get from their preparation to go to Hyperlight is that... No one's ever done this before, and no one's ever going to do it again. This is it.
Scary as hell.
Yeah.
I love Edward James Olmos's face for the rest of this episode. Like, he's got that kind of flat mouth. You know, like the emoji that's just the mouth that's a straight line across?
Mm-hmm.
It's like two closed eyes and a straight across line mouth.
You're talking about Adam face.
Yeah, he's basically doing that for the rest of the episode. Like Colonel Teague is like trying to give him a shoulder rub, trying to make him feel better about the death of his beautiful boy. But he's just flat mouse emojiing through the rest of this episode, starting here.
I think it was a major oversight by us to not talk more about Edward James Olmos's face in the first half of this episode, because it is a character unto itself. Like,
you get two for one when you cast Olmos.
He doesn't need to say anything. His face looks lived in.
Yeah.
He's seen some shit.
He really has.
Just one of the great faces in all of Hollywood.
And with that kind of bitter resolve, they prepare to make the jump to... Is Hyperlight the term?
We've heard so many different terms for faster than light travel over the course of pilot season. I can't keep track of them anymore.
In Battlestar Galactica, it is known as hyperlight.
Okay. Wouldn't it be fine if they were all just called warp speed or hyperspace or something? Like, can we just all like agree on one thing as a science fiction community?
We can't. We can't agree on anything. This is why we have conventions where we argue about that shit.
Yeah. Starbuck comes back aboard, ship shot to hell.
The news you don't want to get after narrowly surviving fighter jet combat in space is that, yeah, some people you expected to see after getting out of your jet fighter are dead. And also, Leah Dama, your maybe crush, is among them.
The guy that she wanted to fix the spaceship, too. So, like, I mean, she's really fucked in multiple different ways here.
In the first half of this pilot, the version you got of Starbuck was the shit kicker, the ne'er-do-well, the one who gets thrown in the brig. And I think this is the first scene in the show where you really get to see Katie Sackhoff's range. Because when she absorbs this news, I was very surprised by this moment and her character's reaction to this. This is something that betrays something deeper going on with her, not just in her relationship to Apollo, but as a character in her own right, you know? This is like the magic of casting her.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that she can play Starbuck as macho as she's played the character up to this point and then have a moment of really three-dimensional vulnerability like this and have it feel contiguous, like it's the same character doing both things, is really great. We cut away to Boomer's Raptor, where she's sitting in the cockpit with this kid with the tragic haircut. We learn his name is Boxy.
What's more tragic for this character, his haircut or his name?
I don't know. He's really fighting an uphill battle with me. The actor's name is Connor Widows, so really just a tough road to hoe all around.
Boxy sounds like the sort of boy that would ask for more, please, in an orphanage a very long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm Boxy, and I'm hungry.
You're enjoying a fine fat goose while I have to eat porridge.
Oh, poor Boxy. You really get a sense for how small this ship is on the inside. I don't think we could really clock this in the first half, but like when you see everyone cramped in the back and Boxy for some reason riding shotgun, I don't think that's fair. This is the sort of rule we come up with as friends, you know? The longer-legged folks sit up front. The Benjamin R. Harrisons of the world ride shotgun. The rest of us ride in storage.
6 of 12 shows up as a vision, I guess. Like, he sees her. Nobody else does.
Doesn't seem like there's room for her back there.
Yeah.
We described her a lot in the first half of the episode. I think one of the qualities we didn't describe was her height. She is a taller lady, and it doesn't seem like she would comport herself to riding in the back the way that she has in order to have this conversation.
She gets to ride shotgun because those legs are not going to fit in the third row.
This is going to be a problem for Gaius, it seems, these constant visions.
Yeah. So we cut back to Battlestar, and it's getting ready for its faster-than-light jump. And I love the way the ship kind of expands. It's like one of those like really fancy RVs where when you park it, the sides pop out, so it gets like twice as wide as it is when it's actually on the road.
That's a great call. Yeah, they gotta pull in the pop tent out of the side, retract that thing back.
Yeah,
resume jump prep.
Those expanding parts are where the wipers go in and out of. So. Mm-hmm. It has to like pack itself up tight to go to hyperlight. And they're heading to this place called Ragnar, which is where they're going to get all of the ammunition that they need to fight this war. Everybody gets really nervous. We get like a full countdown cut around the ship to all of the people stressing out about what the hyperlight jump is going to look like. And they do like the Steven Spielberg zoom in, dolly out shot to underline how weird this feels for the people on board.
I hate this part.
Jumping.
if you're tired of competing for a stall in the communal shower, I think now's the time to take one. You could probably get in there pretty easily.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows where that water's going to go, though, during transit. Here's another thing about Hyperlight. It seems as though the transit is instantaneous or instantaneous-esque. You know, yeah. Like, it's not like you're in the warp tunnel for a while during. You just blurp from one side into the other. It's more Event Horizon than it is Star Trek.
It's piece of paper folded in half with a pencil poking through it.
Excuse me, that's Vanessa and that's mine.
For all of the nervousness, like, it really didn't seem to be that big a deal. Like, it didn't knock anything over. This, like, it's not like Andromeda where the pilot is like, oh! Flying all over the screen.
I don't like my pilots that aggro. Like, I like that this is sort of a calm transit.
Yeah.
Their destination also reminded me of Event Horizon. Like, it is stormy and ugly looking.
Yeah.
Where they arrive.
It's, I guess, like a nebula, or is it a gas giant and then they're inside of the clouds of the gas giant or something?
I think it's the second one. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is very Event Horizon.
The gateway is open, and you are all coming with me.
Back on Colonial One, it is not destroyed.
Yeah.
I mean, people just got knocked to the floor.
Everybody fell down, go boom, you know? That happens. You just get up, dust yourself off, and jump to Hyperlight.
The president got knocked down, but she gets up again and gets right back to work. She goes right to the hangar area. If you thought Apollo was dead by flying his fighter jet away in the first half of the episode, kind of a strange place for her to go. But when she arrives, there he is, on the ground, knocked down like everyone else. And what he explains in this scene is that he only made it look like he had died. He caused an explosion to make it look like not only he had died to the president, but that the Cylon missiles had detonated. And neither of them know if this ruse is going to work on the Cylons, if they can tell if they've actually been destroyed or not. So Rosalind has got to hurry with this evacuation of the civilian ship so they can light out of there.
It's one of those, like, we came up with this idea when we were in college, but we never actually tried it. And I love Rosalind going like, I didn't want to know all that. Like, I didn't want to know how close we came to actually dying.
The lesson here is not to ask follow-up questions, but simply to say thank you, Captain Apollo, for saving our collective asses.
I like their banter with each other. Like, this is clearly a moment where she outranks him by 1,000 levels, and yet they can have a sort of jocularity with each other. I like it.
Yeah, so the Cylons will presume them dead, the rest of the fleet will presume them dead, and they can recover as many survivors as possible now. Meanwhile, the Battlestar goes down a hole toward the space station that they've been heading toward. And I love, there's just like a little scene of bridge business that it is not there to like move the plot forward at all. But I just loved this little scene where it's kind of submarine patter, the way they're talking about like down bubble and and steering the ship, like preparing for their turns and stuff.
It was unclear to me whether or not these tunnels in the clouds were static.
Yeah.
Or if they were just navigating through these holes in the gas. I think it's the second one, because it seems like a very active bit of business that they're doing in order to steer down to the station.
Totally. There's going to be some turbulence. We get like a little moment where Starbuck kind of sads out about Apollo and all the 85 people that died in the nuclear attack. And then we arrive at Ragnar Station, which is, there's like three like hula hoops going around it. There's like a spindle in the middle. It's very spooky from the outside. It's very rusty and spooky on the inside.
This place is a tomb.
It seems like a good place to hide all your weapons in the middle of this cloud on a very dark looking station.
I mean, they've got a resupply. Like, the one thing that the Battlestar did bring was a good supply of body bags, because we do see lots of body bags in these shots.
It's true.
But they have no ammunition, so they got to stop here.
Go find me some bullets, Chief.
The crew boards the station, and like an old person doing cocaine, it's looking dusty and rusty. Except for one dude with a weapon inside, And no one was expecting to see this guy.
This guy is acting a lot more like he has something on the soldiers that surround him. He's like, drop your... like, you don't have a team, man.
Yeah. I'd give anything to have this guy's confidence.
What are you talking about here? Yeah. So Chief Tyrol has to kind of big dog him down. We cut back over to Colonial One, where the Raptor has landed aboard Colonial One, and Boomer and her civilian rescuees are being welcomed.
One of them is Gaius Baltar, and I love the shit that Boomer flings right at him.
Hope he's worth it.
Like, she's still sore about her buddy being left behind on Caprica.
Yeah.
Apollo's there to greet and tells Gaius that the new president wants to see him, and when he does, the president gives him a job as the new Cylon tech, and also wants Boomer to use the Raptor that she came in on to go out and collect nearby survivors, because what the Raptor can do is do that hyperlight jumping. It can jump all around to these civilian ships that she picks up on radar and bring some people back in relative safety, because what we know about hyperlight is that you can't pick it up on radar or anything. Like, it's a really great way to evade the Cylons.
Right. We cut back to the space station, and this gunman that they found is like, he's really seeming like strung out.
I thought drugs too.
He's like sweaty and jumpy in this way that sort of indicates that he's not doing well on a level that is not just based on him being stuck on a dusty and rusty space station.
Oh, come on. I almost fit in my red dress.
He talks about not wanting to go to jail or taken alive, and he wants a helicopter and money and unmarked bills and, you know, all the stuff that a tweaker like him wants in a situation like this.
They're like, Hilo's dead, man. Hilo died in the first act of this thing.
The chief is cool as hell because he's like, look, you just got that one weapon and I've got thousands of people on a big ship behind me. Like, can you take us all?
Yeah.
And this argument is persuasive enough to have this guy set down his weapon. Good job, chief.
Yeah, he guns of the many'd him.
Back in the first class cabin of the president's ship. I really like how this thing is appointed.
Yeah, it's nice.
Really, really comfy looking seats.
I mean, it'd be a little bit nicer if they had the like cubicles where you could close the door, you know?
Yeah, but this seems like less of an international route and more of a domestic way to travel.
Sure, yeah.
In that way.
Yeah.
This is where Gaius Baltar set up an improvised office, and he's got the paperwork of a guy who's really busy and the orange juice of a guy who needs the energy to do that work.
Mm-hmm.
And that empty seat next to him is filled once again by his imaginary girlfriend.
Ignoring me won't help.
And she makes the case here, a really interesting case, that maybe this isn't as an imagination. Maybe this is a chip that she put in his brain after he passed out from fucking her all those times. Like, maybe she is real.
I would love to see the flashback of that, like the, I don't know, like chopsticks up the nose or something moment.
As they talk, it's clear that her mission wasn't just military strategy. It was like weirdly personal at the same time, because for her, it's not just about winning the war. She also wants to be loved in the process. It's real Old Testament shit, the way she puts it.
Don't you understand? God is love.
She has some sort of religious devotion to the idea of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragic thing about that is love is also heartbreaking. And at some point, he's going to make her cry, and then she's going to rust and not be able to work anymore because she's a robot.
Yeah. The sexual tension between them remains. I want to be clear about that. In every possible scene, it appears that she's there to both kick him in the balls and stroke those same balls.
The audition must have just been like, okay, here is like a styrofoam head. We want to see what it looks like when you nibble this head's earlobe. And they cast whoever did that the best.
Back on Ragnar Anchorage, Adama's there already. The commanders take an audience with this total whack job from a scene ago. And I guess he's as good a guy as any to give the grand tour.
Yeah.
What he tells Adama is that he's kind of a Lord of War type person. Yeah. And his plan all along was to sell the weapon stockpile on the open market.
I mean, people need to defend themselves, and they're like looking in what sort of looks like a silo, and the crew is really like frantically trying to gather up all the ammunition that they came there for. And so they're not being as careful as you want to be. And it's like people didn't even learn the lessons of the rock, you know? Like, when ZX gas goes on the floor, it's bad.
You spasm so hard you break your own back and spit your guts out.
But that's after your skin melts off.
These guys drop something explosive. It like, blows Adama and this guy through the door, and then the door shuts. And then when you cut back to the outside of the silo, I love how it's like totally caved in, like across the threshold of the door. So you're like, yeah, there's no fucking way that's opening.
We cut to the inside, and Adama's ears have exploded in just a mess of gore. He's never going to hear again after being in this metal enclosure when that bomb goes off.
They are stuck in there, and Chief Tyrell's like, okay, we're going to get a crew, guys, with like a cutting torch and come open this up for you. And he's like, no, fuck that. Like, we're going to go out a different way. No extra calories are going to be burned on single people. We're too desperate right now.
The take that Lioban Kanoi gives here, which is the name of the tweaker, sure does seem menacing, right?
Is there another way out of here?
Yeah.
This is not the sort of guy you want to be locked in with at a time like this, I don't think.
Yeah. Speaking of menacing, the president has gathered herself quite a fleet at this point, and she's on board a ship that is all like garden domes. You know, just making really like profound personal connections with the people that are being rescued.
You think this captain is pretty relieved to be in wartime and finally able to introduce himself as a cruiser ship captain and not a botanical cruiser ship captain at social events? Botanical cruiser to cruiser captain is like Star Trek podcaster to comedy podcaster, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a big upgrade. I don't think we'll ever do it.
No. Yeah.
Unless it's wartime.
Yeah.
He's loving this for himself. She meets like a totally adorable little girl.
What's your name?
Cammy.
Hi, Cammy.
This is a scene just made to introduce us to pre-deads.
So sad. All of those marijuana plants growing in this guy's cruiser size grow up.
Yeah.
All soon to be gone. It's tragic.
Poor Cammy is already an orphan and doesn't even know it.
Yeah.
And back on Colonial One, we learn about the size of this armada, right? 60 ships. The trouble is only 40 of them can go to Hyperlight. And that's going to be a problem for the last 20. They're going to have to move people from those 20 to the other 60. They're no good to them.
Yeah.
Those slow-ass ships.
Boomer has found the last remaining ship of human stuff, and fortunately it's a refinery ship. It like makes some vital resource that they need. So, that's good.
That's big.
But when she blips back into the fleet with that ship, it seems like either they were followed or just like by random happenstance, a Cylon attack fighter blips in not too long after and sees where the fleet is. So they realize like, oh shit, we got to get out of here. Like everybody has to go to Hyperlight immediately so that when the Cylons show up, they don't kill all of the remainder of humanity.
The urgency and immediacy of the next conversation is really heavy because it's kind of a trolley problem here. On one track, it's the future of humanity, and on the other, it's a handful of sublight ships and their crews.
Right.
And President Roslin doesn't hesitate. At this moment, she does those sublight ships. She decides to just do them right there.
Order the fleet to jump to Ragnar immediately.
This is a McLaughlin group in which, like, there are winners and losers.
Yeah.
You know?
Issue one.
It's not just, like, for the interestingness of the debate between the big ideas. It's like, so the people on the 20 ships that don't have FTL drives, We are just going to have to leave them behind because we do not have time to load them onto anything, because the Cylons are going to be up our ass the second that fighter gets back to its mothership. And so the order is given, and it's not instantaneous. Like, the thing that is so gut-wrenching about this is there's like the countdown and like the people on the radio going like, wait, we're just leaving everybody. And the other people that are like, wait, you're just leaving us? Fucking brutal, man.
Yeah, to get it from all sides here the way she does, it's an incredible scene for her character, because she comes to this decision so quickly because time is of the essence, but also she's made to endure the consequences of it, the emotional consequences, I mean, almost immediately and publicly too. Like, it seems like these radio calls are being played throughout the ship, and that's rough. Almost as rough as the scene before when Cousin Greg tells her that Cammy is definitely going to die because she's going to be left on that plant ship.
Yeah.
You didn't have to say that, Cousin Greg.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Is that bad?
She's like, what about all those marijuana plants? He's like, I think they're going to go too. And she's like, no! No!
Could we stay behind, like, for a moment and just sort of suck up the vapor after it goes? Doesn't seem possible.
Yeah.
One person that should be left behind but isn't is Kanoi. Adama stays with him, and he seems to be getting worse and worse as they move through those hallways.
Just got bad allergies, you know?
Who do you think you're fooling, Kanoi? Not Adama. Kanoi sort of accuses Adama of being, like, military tough,
yeah,
making him lead and stuff throughout the halls and so forth. But, like, I think all it is just, like, the cold neutrality of an Adama not making any decisions at all or betraying any of his feelings about this guy to him.
I was thinking maybe it had something to do with, like, Cylons make great smelling farts, and Adama didn't want to miss out on any of that.
Yeah, the Cylons fart helium in this show.
It's a perfectly natural bodily function. And it's odorless.
And another example of all science fiction series stealing from each other.
Kanoi's like, I'm a keen observer of human nature. And Adama's like, you sure are. How long till we're out of here?
Back on Galactica, the serious business of loading the warheads continues when they pick up 50 ships on radar. And this momentarily sets off a panic when they think it's an incoming attack, but it's not. It's colonial signals.
Yeah.
And I love what Tig does here by, like, asking for like double and triple checking this shit. Like, he knows this is going to be an ongoing problem.
Right.
And potentially an example of Cylons using colonial signals to attack them.
Imagine Cylons mimicking humans. What would we do then?
I know.
So, yeah, they really are about to whip themselves into a tizzy, and then they realize that this is, in fact, the human fleet. And it's not long after that he's nose to nose with the new president. And he is just, like, he has not seen any of these parts of the episode up till now, so he doesn't have any context for her being president. He doesn't know who she is.
Mm-hmm.
He is not interested in helping her or taking orders from her or giving her any of his time until Apollo kind of browbeats him into, like, at least give us some, like, emergency rations. And he's like, okay, you can take the rations, but I'm not helping unload them. Like, you could do it yourself.
Where are you at with Tig at this point? Like, do you just assume that he's a little bit drunk in every scene that's followed? I've kind of assumed his sobriety as soon as the war popped off, but maybe that's incorrect. I don't know. Like, the reason I ask that is because, like, in scenes like this where he's dealing with the president or whatever, does she think he's drunk?
Yeah, can she smell the whiskey on his breath?
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Nothing about this scene suggests that.
Yeah, I think I'm with you that he has not had anything to drink since the danger started to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not totally clear how much time has passed, but his bruise is getting, like, less and less noticeable from scene to scene. So I feel like this is, like, a couple of days later, if not more.
Maybe this is healing gas out there for the humans. Think about that.
Wow.
I'm so sad we don't meet the ship's doctor in these two episodes. Because it would be neat to know, like, maybe the reason they're healing so fast is because of that awesome dude.
Good doctor, huh?
Yeah.
You're a lousy salesman.
We cut around the ship and a bunch of sexy reunions take place. We get Chief Tyrol and Boomer falling into each other's arms. We get that teen aide to the president getting a sweet kiss from the lady he met in the bathroom earlier.
Yeah, this is as shocking to him as it is to anyone else, I think.
Yeah. And then we get Apollo and Starbuck running back into each other.
It's wild how Boxy witnesses all three of these reunions.
Yeah.
He's grossed out by all of them.
Darwin not grossed out by any of them. Darwin really enjoyed. Why this have to air on NBC and not Showtime late at night?
Sequest aired on NBC.
That was back in the days when NBC would air something that was a hard R.
We need to score a lot of laughter fast.
We're licensed businessmen.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
It's a handshake and not a kiss for Apollo and Starbuck.
Yeah.
And they get back into their old patter of awkward ball kicking.
Yeah.
It really does not seem flirtatious at all, this relationship that they have, right?
Not yet.
Yeah.
We cut back over to the station, and the commander and his increasingly wan and sweaty friend are still, you know, going around with their flashlights looking for a way out. And this is when Adama calls this guy on his Cylon being.
What is it about this place? What's it doing to me?
Must be your allergies.
This is great. This station is here because they know that something about the storm that it's in is bad for Cylons. That's what's causing this guy to break down. And he's like, well, it doesn't matter. Like, the rest of the Cylons are going to be here soon. And it's not like it's going to take them hours to kill all of you. Like, I'll be dead, but I'm like that other lady. I can't really die.
This guy starts trying to seduce Adama. Like, is that the Cylon's only trick?
Nibbling on his earlobe? What the hell?
You look at me sometimes.
What?
I want to know if you like me.
Well, of course.
Can I kiss you?
No!
I love this moment for this Cylon because it seems as though, like while we know that their location is poisonous to him, and he really appears weak and close to death, there's like this moment where with the last of this character's strength, it starts kicking some ass.
Yeah.
And becomes a hard pipe-hitting Cylon in short order.
I'm gonna get medieval on your ass.
He becomes a hard flashlight-hitting commander in return.
Right. But Adama takes this guy's best shot and gets one up on him, turns the tables, and just beats him to death with his flashlight.
Yeah.
And his face is covered in Cylon blood. This is American Psycho style beating that's happening here.
Is that a raincoat?
Yes, it is.
Can't believe this was on network television.
Yeah. On Galactica, Gaius tells the lieutenant on the bridge that this issue with the Cylon's power to disable colonial ships has to do with a software update that was installed in a bunch of these ships, newer ones especially, and the software update was tainted. And Galactica doesn't have it because Galactica doesn't have network computers. And so part of this conversation is like, cool, well, let's definitely continue to not have those on Galactica and also like get the word out to ships with network computers who might have installed this software update. Like, scrub that. Get that out of here.
Yeah, Gaius pulls like a Cat 5 cable out of his duffel bag and Lieutenant Gaeta like slaps it out of his hand. And he's like, no, no, no networks.
Paper porn, this. Digital porn, no, no.
He rolls up the porn and smacks Gaius on the nose. I love Gaeta going like, man, like you must be like really feeling a type of way about this whole situation. And Gaius is like, huh? He's like, you know, like the way your invention was used to bring our species to the brink of collapse, like where there's like 50,000 of us left and it's kind of your fault. And he's like, right, yeah, bummer.
There's a version of this scene where you're just living in the lieutenant's perspective and you don't see number six having the conversation with Gaius in front of him. And it's a great kind of triangulation of what Gaius is feeling, because he's trying to act normal. She makes it impossible for him to do that with all of the shit talking she does about his incapacity for guilt. And it's a great reminder that Gaius Baltar is a scumbag and he's just sort of masquerading as a person worthy of sympathy. And the lieutenant is a character who helps us remember that.
Gaeta walks away and Six of Twelve's conversation with Gaius continues. And now she's like, hey, I'm actually doing you favors here. And she like grabs his chin and directs his POV around the bridge till he sees this Wi-Fi router up on the like pile of TVs in the middle of the room. She's like, you seen that anywhere before? And he flashes back to seeing it in her Halliburton briefcase that she had like back on Caprica. Which is like an amazing like bit of like his memory contains this like random detail of something that she had in her purse that he didn't know what it was.
Rummaging around past the whips and chains, there was this device in there that he remembers. And there it is on the bridge of the Galactica. That's going to be a problem, right? What does it mean, Ben?
The implication is that there is another flesh job on board, just like Six of 12. And he's like, well, I got to tell somebody. And she's like, you idiot. Like, what are you going to do? Say there's a Cylon on board I know because of that Wi-Fi router over there. Like, they're gonna know that you're up to something immediately.
It's a weird moment because, like, to everyone who can see him, he's having Dan Aykroyd-style ghost sex out in public during this conversation. And also, the conspiracy is about pinning this on a character we saw earlier on in the episode, the PR specialist, Aaron Doral. And he's a civilian, so that makes him a good candidate. Like, he doesn't belong here the way the military folks do.
She doesn't even go here!
And maybe this is someone that can be scapegoated into taking the blame for this.
I mean, he also is just on Gaius's bad side because he walks in before she can finish him off, you know?
I want to talk a little bit about the music sting that plays every time Six appears. What do you think about that?
I remember that being like one of the main reasons that I didn't really care for this as a series when I tried watching it. back in the day.
Oh.
Because I remember there being like three episodes in a row where this phenomenon happened, and it just kind of like, I couldn't get on board with it.
Hmm.
I think it's very effective in the miniseries. I think it's maybe just a device that they like overused when they took this to series.
I really liked its utility to cement the idea that we were changing realities in this small way when Six appears. But I think it also functions in a different way, which is, it sounds kind of stopwatchy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've seen this entire series, that's relevant.
Hmm.
It's like the audio embodiment of time and anxiety all in one piece of music. I think it's really great. Maybe it would grind on a person if you were to binge watch this show. But at this point, I really like how it's deployed.
Yeah, I'm all for its use in the pilot. So I love the cut here because the scene ends with the idea that like Gaius is the only human that knows that Cylons can look like humans. And we cut over to Adama telling Colonel Tighe, like, so yeah, the Cylons can look like humans now.
Fun edit for comedy there.
An edit for comedy with a very banged up Commander Adama. He's very bloody. He goes and finds his son in his quarters looking at a family portrait.
At no point does Lee Adama ask his dad, what the hell happened to your face? Why are you covered in blood?
Not here or here so much, but right here.
Don't hug me. What? Get off of me. Ugh.
The factory that makes these uniforms doesn't exist anymore. That planet has been glassed. Like, I can't get another one of these.
There's a McLaughlin group after this.
Issue two.
Where Gaius and Tighe and Adama review the postmortem report on Leoben Kanoi. And what they want from Gaius is a way to screen human from Cylon. And also, this is very important, you got to keep this assignment to yourself. Because people will freak out if they know that Cylons can look like people.
Dr. Gaius is going to be good at keeping shit to himself, I suspect.
Yeah.
This is a very The Founders style problem, though. Like, everybody that you meet could potentially be a bad guy from where they're sitting. So they got to figure out a way to defend against this. And we cut down to the launch bay where Starbuck is getting ready to go on another space mission in one of the Vipers. Basically, the mission is she's going to go fly right to the edge of the cloud.
Where she's got to be.
She harnesses it. She preserves it. It feeds her. Yeah, she's just going to basically peek out from behind the clouds to see if anything bad is going on outside.
Under no circumstances are you to engage the enemy.
Apollo impresses upon her, don't try to be a great pilot. Just be a recon pilot and let history decide.
Yeah, she tells him that that's rhetorical nonsense, and then she puts a CD in the 5-disc changer in her Viper and takes off.
Let's rock and roll!
Six.
Interesting moment for Starbuck to admit that it was her fault that Apollo's brother died.
Yeah.
Starbuck was his flight instructor, and she passed him, even though he was a shit pilot.
So a lot of the misplaced anger that Apollo has for his dad maybe should have been aimed at her. And it kind of goes to explain a little bit about the previous scene when she was told that Apollo was dead. Like, that the way she reacted to that, I feel like, contained some of the guilt she has felt over this.
It also adds more context to the picture of Apollo's brother and Starbuck together that she keeps on the mirror in her locker.
Yeah.
A picture that Apollo is also in, just on the folded inward side.
Yeah.
It's kind of cruel.
It's cruel and also like kind of sad that she used a really sharp pencil to poke his eyes out before she folded it over.
You kind of get the sense that eventually in this story, she'll fold that picture in another way that folds the brother out of it, the dead brother.
Yeah.
And makes it so it's just her and Apollo in it.
Zach, fuck him.
Sort of like the worst pictures you see on dating websites are just the one person and the arms of the ex around them.
Dating websites are before my time, Adam, so I don't have any experience with that, but I'm sure your wife will be interested to hear that you do.
Maybe my general knowledge of all kinds of things would shock and dismay her.
So Doral gets arrested by the security services, and he's very convincing that he is just a man. He's just a normal man.
We're just normal men.
He's not a Cylon.
I study public relations.
I like how rusty their brig is on this ship. Like, yeah. This is like the one part of the ship that they do not clean ever.
Colonel Tag has a good question here, which is, if we're in a place that has radiation that affects Cylons, why isn't the PR guy affected in the same way as that whack job on the station?
Yeah.
Unclear at this point.
He's not Juan. Why is he not Juan?
But, like, contextually sweaty because he's in a very stressful situation, trying to make it clear that he's been arrested for a crime he didn't commit.
Right.
He's a human man.
Tin man.
He's not a tin man. Which is what a Cylon is.
Yeah, I guess they are.
He's in the clink because what Gaius Baltar has done is taken hair samples from as many people as he can find. How was he able to do this without being caught is a question that I had. Just don't worry about that.
Yeah.
No one noticed.
I'm picturing he was just going around finding people's hairbrushes and taking samples.
Yeah.
The way they did Pulaski in that one episode of TNG.
Yeah.
So on the bridge, they pull down this Wi-Fi router, and everybody that's sitting around working on their laptop is like, hey, what the fuck is going on here? Is the internet down for everyone? What is this? And they're like, yeah, this is a Cylon device. We'll have to put it in a briefcase and just take it somewhere else. Like, no, get it off the ship. You don't know what it is. You don't know what it does.
Yeah, and giving it to Gaius Baltar feels a little dirty, too.
Yeah. Starbuck goes out through the clouds, and I guess these clouds are also causing, like, comms blackout, so she loses contact with the Battlestar on her way out. And I thought they did a really nice job with this effect of her Viper getting just like to the edge of the clouds, and as they clear, seeing an absolutely massive fleet of Cylon ships just kind of hanging out outside of the storm waiting for them.
The scale of this is so disappointing. It's not just fighter planes. It's like the heavy carrier style cruisers in the fleet. Like, it's just 1,000 ships out there.
Like, so big that she can't see any space through the canopy of her ship because it's all cruiser up there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nuts.
So we finally get a meeting between Commander Adama and the president, and pretty high stakes first encounter. I mean, I guess they've talked on the radio before, but this is the first time they're like face to face.
They don't have time to do a bunch of diplomatic bullshit. I love how President Roslin just cuts right to the point. She's like, are you going to coup me? Is that what this is?
She says, don't coup me, bro.
And when he makes it clear that he's not there to coup, it's clear that they need to figure out what to do between them, like collaboratively or otherwise. Like, her instinct, she makes this pretty clear, is that the war is over and humanity is lost, and the main goal of humanity at this point should be fucking and not fighting. Adama feels otherwise.
Yeah. He's like, you expect me to get hard at a time like this? And she like sweeps everything off the table. And she's like, come on, we got to start now. And he's like, whoa, 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 let's get out of danger first.
It's good energy between these two main characters of the show.
Yeah, they are an interesting match because it's clear that they come from a place of respect with everybody that they meet. Like, that's something that we've learned about both of them. And that's not always true with the people that they meet. Like, not everybody treats them with the respect that they start with everyone. And I think that because they start respectful toward each other, they're able to build a foundation here, even though they completely disagree. He's like, this war hasn't even started yet. Like, I'm getting these munitions so that I can go take the fight to the Cylons and do my fucking job. And she's like, the war is not starting. It is over. We need to get the fuck out of here and save as many people as we possibly can. And I need your help to do that.
I think early on in the first part of this episode, the show was trying to make you believe that Adama was wrong, that Adama is a past person. He's not right for the moment. He's going to hold humanity back. But I feel like this scene is one of the first times you start to believe that maybe the show thinks that they're both right. Maybe the show believes that Adama is at times more right than President Roslin. They seem more equal than they've ever been.
It's a really cool scene. I think that this is the De Niro meets Pacino scene in Heat, mm-hmm. in a way, for this pilot. Like, they've been such forces throughout this story. And now that she has become the president in an emergency and he has become the head of the military in an emergency, they've sort of become new characters in a way at this point.
I really love how no one has argued in a long, long time, since maybe the first moment it happened, that she's just the Secretary of Education. She doesn't know shit.
Yeah.
She has been so sturdy throughout her short time as president that, like, everyone's down with her being the president. That's never even an argument.
That is now your chair, Captain.
Oh, it's a new ship.
Back on the bridge, Starbuck's report comes in, and it is grim. What we have here is a Paulston Nebula situation. The Cylon fleet is waiting for them to come out, and once their resources are gone from hiding, that's just what they're going to have to do, right? The idea is floated, what about just jumping from within the storm? Can we do that? We've already done one insane jump. Like, can we make it more insane?
No, we can't do that.
I'm feeling lucky. Let's do it again.
So I was like, let's let it ride, baby.
So, like, very quickly, they kind of workshop, well, no, let's not jump from within the storm. Let's, like, get outside the hole and then jump, like, from its rim. And Adama's like, cool, even better. What I'll do is I'll take the Galactica out first. I'll kind of turn her over the hole, provide cover for the civilian ships to leave and go to hyperspace, and then we will be the last to leave.
It's a decision he makes after seeing Billy and Dualla kind of flirting with each other over on the other side of the bridge. Like, seeing two of the younger people on the ship make eyes at each other is sort of the moment that persuades him that the president's position is the correct one. Like, we do, in fact, need to get these kids fucking, like, as soon as we possibly can. So
I think the thing that inspired him was, like, maybe it's the president's aide that's, like, Galactica, you know, clumsy and bad up against Duella, who is, like, a total fucking knockout and, like, way out of his league. Like, he can see them together and go, like, that's us and the Cylons out there.
This war is over. We lost.
They get ready to do this plan. They're going to get all 50,000 civilians on their 40 ships to hyperlight out of there while Galactica kind of provides covering fire. They ditch Doral on the station and leave him with some food and water. And he's like, no, don't leave me. I am a normal man.
We're just innocent men.
I insist. And they're like, you know, like, we kind of believe you, but we just can't risk it right now.
If they did this 15 minutes earlier in the show's runtime, I think it allows for more time for the cruelty to set in. And it feels unjust and bad longer in a way that I think works against the revelation that happens later on. Like, you only want to live with this cruelty for a short time before the big reveal happens, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, and it's like, we've already seen them abandon thousands of people once, so abandoning one guy is, like, not going to move the needle as much.
They've heard screams of resistance before over the radio, but none of them have ever said, I'm a PR professional. You're going to need me.
The cloud of Cylon bad guys is waiting for them, as promised, when they get out there. It's a great battle sequence. We get suppressing fire from the ship, which is now armed to the teeth. It's got all these turrets that I didn't get a great look at them, but it sort of looks like there's maybe like a bubble in the middle of the turret. So like there's somebody working the turret. That's the job I want. That looks fun as hell.
It's so fun to see how Galactica fights. And out come the fighters to fight the Cylon fighters. And that leaves Galactica to be like providing cover fire for the missiles coming in from these base stars. Base stars are what the giant Cylon ships are called. And the scope of this fight is enormous, and little by little, the civilian ships are blurping away.
I think none of the big civilian ships get hit by missiles. We do get a few missiles hitting the Galactica. Unclear if these are nukes, but if they are, like, it takes a kind of a lot of nukes to the side of it over the course of this fight.
Apollo's wing doesn't get nuked. It just gets shot off in a conventional way.
Plain old way. He's still in the fight. He's still like fairly effective for a while.
How many lives does Apollo have in 2 days?
Yeah, he got a lot of one-up mushrooms before this episode started.
Yeah.
Starbuck does wind up having to save his ass many times in this dogfight, though. They blurp all the civilian ships away and all of the Vipers come home except for Starbuck and Apollo. The missiles are coming in, and Starbuck kind of hooks the nose of her ship onto one of the forward guns of Apollo's ship.
Their ships are 69ing.
They're doing it.
Your reference to those pods needing to be retracted for hyperlight comes into play here, because this is a door that's closing.
Right.
And its aperture is getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah. Like the zipper is going up on the fly and they do not have a lot of time, but they make it in there. You know, it's not a pretty landing, but land they do, and the Battlestar blips out just before like 10 more missiles would hit it.
We get a passage of time here and we arrive at a funeral service for everyone who died. And one thing we didn't mention before was, like, their destination on this jump was further out than I think anyone had ever been.
Yeah.
They're in uncharted space here. And so the idea is that they may have bought themselves some relative calm being so far away from where the Cylons are. And that same religious figure that presided over President Rosalind swearing in, she has some words, and then it's Commander Adama's turn to speak, and he turns his speech from a rallying cry toward the mission ahead, which is, he's read those religious scrolls. He might not seem like a religious man, but he knows what they say. There's a 13th tribe. We all know. Now, we all know that we're of the 12 colonies to make up our society, but what my theory presupposes is there is a 13th tribe, and it is on Earth, and that is where we are going, because the Cylons don't even know about this. This is Code 47. This is for Captain's eyes only.
Yeah. He knows where it is, though, because he is senior enough in the military to have been read in on the existence of and location of more humans, and that's where they're going to go. They're going to go live on Earth with the rest of humanity. They're going to have an ally. And I can't believe he's been holding out on everyone like this.
I hate to give this away, Ben, but at the very end of the series, they do arrive at Earth, except it's the Earth of today, and it just fucking sucks. Like, these people can't help us. They're fighting each other over resources. They're idiotic.
This is the 13th tribe? Ugh. And they just turn around and head back.
It's like the end of Spaceballs. We get a couple of vignettes after this ceremony. Well, we get a moment where Tag apologizes to Starbuck. you know, praising her for that 69ing of her ship that she did with his, and to apologize for the card game incident. And this seems pretty big of him. Starbuck does not take this as a big of him moment.
No.
It takes two big of him. And as it is, there's only one, because she calls him a bastard and weak and a drunk.
Oh, man. She fucking stomps him.
Yeah.
You're dangerous.
He does not get the detente that he was looking for in this moment.
Michael Hogan plays Tig, and he does this thing with his jaw.
They're both doing that thing with their jaws. Like, their jaws are, like, flapping. They're just rocking while they talk to each other.
I think you're used to seeing this in, like, stressful times for characters, but it almost seems like Tig physically cannot make the words necessary to do what he's doing. It's not so much stress as it is, like, he's physically incapable. I thought it was a really fascinating performance.
I mean, I liked this for both characters.
Mm-hmm.
They will remain at Starboggerheads.
In the captain's quarters, President Roslin asks Commander Adama, what the fuck was that bullshit back there? Earth? Are you kidding me? I'm the president, and I've talked to other presidents, and we don't know what the hell you're talking about. And Adama makes it clear that whether or not Earth is real, what they needed was hope. And certainly the president can understand that, right?
It's not that they are going to be surviving. It's they're going to be living for something.
Mm.
Like, I'm just living for the weekend, but we got to, like, have, like, bigger goals as a society, you know?
Right. She agrees to keep this terrible secret, the secret that Earth isn't real. And in exchange, she wants to form a new government. And they come to an agreement on how that government will be divided. It's a two branches of government system where Adama would lead the military and Roslin would handle the civilian part.
Right.
They're never going to get anything done. There's no tie breaking.
Yeah, there's no checks and balances.
Finally, Gaius Baltar encounters Number Six in a hallway and she tells him, you know what's weird? Like, I actually forgot to tell you something pretty important about the Cylons. Check it out. Some of us don't even know we're Cylons. They're just waiting to be activated out there. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Wow.
An interesting cut here happens because we go from this revelation to Tig pouring out his booze. I don't know. That sequence is like, oh, is Tig a Cylon?
Right.
Who is a Cylon and who isn't? Like, the paranoia experienced earlier among characters starts to be given to the viewer here.
Yeah. And then we see Boxy and we're like, oh, fuck, is Boxy a Cylon?
It's Boxy.
Are we going to have to throw Boxy out of there? Like, I mean, worse things have happened, right?
We should probably do it just to be safe.
Wouldn't a robot give a name like Boxy to one of their offspring?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that way. Tig, you can't throw out your booze, man. You got to give it to someone else. Like, yeah. This is the last booze in all of humanity.
They didn't save a distillery ship with a faster-than-light drive.
Give it to the gang in the card game.
They would love it. Doesn't seem like Apollo and his dad are going to completely solve their relationship problems, but they're heading in the right direction.
Hey, Apollo, now would be a great time to tell your dad what Starbuck told you earlier. Like, maybe relieve some of dad's guilt in this moment. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Nope.
Nah. Starbuck smokes a stogie and unfolds her picture to include the living hunk. And Adama finds a folded up note in his room. Unclear who left this here, but it just says, there are only 12 Cylon models. And we cut back to the space station, where Doral is finally starting to look a little bit wan after his exposure to this nebula.
He's just waiting for those doors to open, and once they do, those OG Cylons enter. This is a bookend to the very first scene, in the very first moments of the episode. The chrome Cylons enter, and behind them, a bunch of Number Sixes, a bunch of Loban Kanois, and even a copy of him. And then finally, in the very last moment, their leader looks just like Boomer.
Don't worry, we'll find them.
Wow. Okay, Boomer.
You know what Mark Maron would say? Boomer lives.
Did you like this pilot, Adam?
She'll always bring it home.
I really, really did. I think part of the tragedy of doing pilot season with you is the knowledge that I'm just not going to have time to watch all of the fun series that we've begun here. I hope FODs out there find the time to do that, because I think there's a lot here that's of quality. I think especially Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, it's a good show.
This 3-hour block made me think a lot about Star Trek Discovery, just to bring it back around to what we're going to get back into
next week.
How Star Trek Discovery deals with the prospect of total annihilation, which is a theme every season, and how Discovery very intentionally is about preserving the optimistic vision of the future, no matter what the cost. Like, that is the backbone of every season and of the entire series. And Battlestar Galactica is definitely not that, right? But I don't think it's a negative version of the future either, because there is a lot of hope, like, baked into a lot of the characters.
Right.
And their intentions. I think Battlestar Galactica is realistic, and it kind of reminded me why, like, toxic positivity became a thing. Like, ignoring the reality of a situation can contribute to the bad outcome that you're trying to avoid. And what we have in this series is, like, a version of optimism that is totally grounded in the realism of the moment, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Discovery's so good at preserving the wonder and the beauty of space and the myriad amazing aliens you can meet there, and the assumption that you're going to find good out there somewhere, somehow. That may be a part of Battlestar Galactica. It may be the thing that helps humanity survive, but it's not right on the surface
right in
every scene in a way that I really appreciate. So that's how I feel about this show. And that's how I feel like it relates to Star Trek Discovery.
And I'm just sick and tired of hearing people watch Discovery and say, not my Battlestar Galactica. Fucking exhausting, you know?
Yeah.
It's not even trying to be Battlestar Galactica. Yeah, I think that's well put. I'm very, very excited to get back into Discovery.
Me too.
Especially after a whole bunch of pilots. Like, I definitely am keenly eager to get back with characters that we've known for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But this has been a super fun project, and this was a great way to cap it off. I really, really enjoyed the pilot of Battlestar Galactica, and I hope everybody out there listening did too.
Yeah, that was great fun, Ben. Good job by you and Wendy.
Good job by you. Let's go hit the P1 inbox.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
There's nothing in there.
Oh, right. This episode came out during a Max Fun Drive, a Greatest Trek Drive. So we didn't have P1s on this one. If you'd like to get a P1 for a future episode, it's MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And if you'd like to support the production of this show, it's MaximumFun.org/join.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself an Edward Larkin in the episode?
Edward Larkin! I'm going to give it to Dr. Baltar just because, man, it has got to be really hard to think you're getting a hand job and then realize you're just in the middle of a work environment, kind of like in the middle of the room in front of everyone all the time. Like, that happens to him so much in this episode, where he thinks an HJ is going off, and then, like, somebody says something to him and he snaps out of it, and he's like, fuck, like, I cannot keep blasting in my trousers like this just in front of everyone.
Yeah, those seem like pretty thin fabric trousers he's wearing. Probably not leaving much to the imagination.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like there's a suggestion that number six is sort of enthralled with the size of his crank. Like,
yeah.
Some of the dialogue makes it seem as though there's something special in those pants.
Jack says you got a great big cock.
I guess so.
You know, the Cylons have an agenda, but she has an agenda to be quote unquote loved, but like by a specific item.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I think he is going to be my Edward Larkin. What about you?
I mean, it couldn't be anyone else. He's as or more Edward Larkin than Larkin himself. Absolutely out for himself at all times. Gaius Baltar probably studied the work of Dan Aykroyd in Ghostbusters too, and then probably dialed it back like four clicks off of crossing his eyes, right?
Right. Yeah, he doesn't cross his eyes.
Yeah.
It's clever of him to make it his own thing, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. A new spin, if you will.
On an old favorite. Well, this has been a ton of fun, Adam. Let's close out this episode of Pilot Season with a warning bois from the listeners.
Prepare a buoy and launch it when ready.
Warning buoys.
An emergency buoy.
A warning buoy.
Ben, today's warning bois comes from Mastodon, and it is from someone named Claudius. What I'm doing here is getting in the middle of their conversation, and Claudius's reply goes like this. That Star Trek podcast that delivers extremely niche jokes, where you would need to have seen Crimson Tide and also that single One Voyager episode with Uchip's brother, and then tie it together with a podcast-specific in-joke set to clarinet music. If you like niche jokes and Star Trek, you will love Greatest Trek. Just make sure to start at the beginning. That's a pretty good description of what this show is.
Yeah.
Completely alienating to a newer subscriber, but I think and hope worth the effort.
Yeah, I like an honest review, and I think that it's a testament that a lot of people do like what we do.
My favorite podcasts are built over years and years of in-jokes and getting to know what the hosts are like. Yeah. Like, I get that.
Yeah, totally. Well, if you'd like to hear your words coming out of our mouths, we'd sure appreciate it if you made a social media post about what you like about our show somewhere online. Gets the word out about what we're doing, and we really appreciate it. With that, I think we are going to bring Pilot Season to a close. Of course, Pilot Season isn't over if you become a member. We already have a Pilot Season episode in the bonus feed for members, and I think that we've enjoyed this project enough that we may be doing more of them over on the bonus feed in the future. So, give us a listen over there, but we will be back next week with Discovery. And I think the premiere is going to have two Discovery episodes, so we will be doing in pretty close proximity to each other releases of our review of episode 1 and 2 of the new season of Disco.
And with that, you've heard us prattle on and on about the importance of Greatest Trek Drive. Here is our great producer, Wendy, to maybe make the best case of all for supporting this show. Thanks, Wendy.
Bye-bye.
Greatest Trek is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica, and it's produced and edited by Wendy Pretty. Next week, we're out of pilot season and back into new Star Trek. Look for Ben and Adam's review of the season 5 premiere of Star Trek Discovery in your feed next Friday, and then they'll be back on the following Tuesday with a review of episode 2. Max Fun Drive is winding down, but there is still time today on the final day for you to be the Starbuck to our Apollo and help us crash into the end of this year's drive before it's time to jump. Just takes a minute to set up your membership at MaximumFun.org/join, and we really appreciate your support. Thanks to Adam Ragusea, who composed the theme music for Greatest Trek. You can find him on YouTube by searching for Adam Ragusea. And while you're there, make sure you're following the Greatest Trek YouTube channel. There's lots of fun stuff over there, and watching is another great way to support. Thanks to Nick Ditmore for creating the show art, and thanks to Bill Tilley and Rob Adler for all their work managing the various social media pages that you can find and follow online. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Greatest Trek.
Maximum Fun.
A worker-owned network
of artists-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.